And welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM NPR for the Florida Keys. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Later on the program, Executive Director and Chief Curator Brian Dersom speaks with Judith Bishop about the Low Arts Museum's exciting upcoming exhibitions and programs. Chef Norman Van Aken whips up a word on food in our Florida Keys calendar. Features Andy Newman with enticing event information for your consideration. Our first guest today is a musician, recording engineer, TV, radio, and music event producer, entrepreneur, and visionary. Born in the Bronx, New York, he attended the Manhattan School of Music. In the early 70s, with his friend and fellow musician Dave Grusin, they formed Grusin Rosen Productions and started producing artists such as Jean Lucien, Patty Austin, Lee Ritenour, Earl Clue, and Noel Pointer. In 1978, they signed a long-term contract with Clive Davis of Arista Records to develop new talent under the banner of Arista GRP Records. Dave Valentin, Bernard Wright, Angela Bofill, and Tom Brown hit the national jazz and R&B charts, among many other great musicians. They also produced the first digitally recorded non-classical album in 1979. GRP Records went independent and was founded in 1982, adopting an all-digital recording policy, which helped launch the CD format here in the United States. The company won Billboard Magazine's number one contemporary jazz label for 5 consecutive years. Their artists garnered over 80 Grammy nominations, winning a total of 33 awards. The company's incredible jazz and blues roster included Dr. John, Chick Corea, Tom Scott, Gary Burton, Diana Krall, B.B. King, Arturo Sandoval, Ramsey Lewis, Randy and Michael Brecker, the Yellow Jackets, and Kevin Eubanks, among many more notable musicians. Last year, GRP Records celebrated their 30th anniversary of chart-topping success. After leaving GRP in 1995, our guest went on to co-found one of the first internet content and e-commerce companies, N2K Incorporated, which became a digital music distribution pioneer, offering the first digital downloads in late 1996. In 1998, our guest received the Ernst & Young's Entrepreneur of the Year Award in New Media and Entertainment. Under the banner of his own production company, our guest created and produced the critically lauded PBS TV series Legends of Jazz in High Definition, featuring pianist Ramsey Lewis. He also created and produced the 7-part TV series Recording, The History of Recorded Music, featuring hosts Quincy Jones and Phil Ramone. In 2008, his creation and production Jazz Roots found its first home in the Adrian Arsht Center for the Performing Arts here in Miami. Its 6th annual presentation opens at the Arsht Friday, November the 1st. We're honored to welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat Dr. Larry Rosen. Larry.
Well, thank you, Ed. I'm exhausted after you ran that whole thing. I mean, who did all that stuff? It sounds crazy.
It must be 6 people at least. An incredible career, just magnificent. We could spend hours with you on the radio, but I want to talk about, open up with a few broader topics. All along, you have really been interested in jazz, of course, or throughout your career, but also education, keeping America's classical music alive. Let's concentrate on that and talk about that specific focus over the years.
Well, you know, being a musician, you always look back to the people that encouraged you and influenced you as far as being a player. So musicians, just by their very nature of their love of the music and study of this art, you actually are a historian at the same time. Hmm. So if you're a musician, you have to know about Louis Armstrong. You have to know about Duke Ellington. You have to know about all the big bands. You have to know about the small groups. You have to know about the various styles of jazz and all that. So you somewhat become a historian, and you fall in love with all aspects of that because those are your heroes. Those are my heroes. When I was a kid, 15 years old, I had pictures of all these people hanging in my room. I mean, other kids had either doo-wop stars or the music of the 50s, and I had Sarah Vaughan, Count Basie, Charlie Parker. Those were all my heroes. Most people didn't even know what I was talking about in my friends in high school, but that was where I lived. That's what it was all about for me. So it was a big thing. And so that history, I want to pass that on to mm-hmm. young people.
Well, it's a marvelous bit of American history, certainly. And you are now bringing thousands, I dare say, of students to your Jazz Roots series. And we will, in our second segment together with you, talk about the specifics of your 2013-2014 Jazz Roots series coming up starting in November. But it's very important to keep that American history alive, is it not? Because pop culture has just really forgotten about it for the most part.
Exactly. You know, this is America's music. So it could only happen in America, this music. Mm-hmm. And this music is respected all over the world. You know, I travel around, whether it's in Europe or Asia, people know who these artists are and they know all this music. And in some ways, I think the music gets more respect outside of the country than in the country in a lot of cases. So the music has legs, you know, from that perspective, and people want to hear the music. And my job is to try to make everybody here very conscious, especially young people, about this music and what this great history is, because it can only happen in a multi-ethnic society that mm-hmm. this music could actually be created, because it is, you know, as Quincy Jones, it's a gumbo. It's made mm-hmm. up of all kinds of different elements that are put together, and that's really the social fabric of America. And that's that social fabric created this music, which we call jazz, and all the offshoots of it, whether it's jazz, blues, gospel music, or rock and roll, all the way to hip-hop, it all comes out of the same roots. So that's the story.
You were in such a pivotal place up in New York with your buddy Dave Grusin and developing GRP Records. You, in my humble estimate, carried on the work that Creed Taylor had started with CTI, kind of making jazz contemporary for a new era. Give us a feel of those early days when you had your record company and the distribution by Arista, and you were developing new great talent, essentially in a contemporary jazz mode.
Well, the whole idea of contemporary jazz is like, so what does that mean? If we just think about it, the era before that, like the bebop era or the straight ahead era, if you want to call that, I mean, that music was played and created most of the time in these small clubs, whether it was Birdland or the Blue Note or those kinds of clubs in New York City primarily, and clubs like that all around the country. It was piano-based drums, and many times it was saxophone and trumpet was the lead line. You know, they may have a couple of other players with it. And they played these tunes based on the American classics, based on I Got Rhythm. And these great musicians, Charlie Parker, would write songs on top of those chord changes. And when they made records at that particular time, a producer would take that group who played in the club the night before, set up a couple of microphones, and have them reproduce exactly what they did the night before in some form or other. The solos will be different, but they're playing the same material primarily. When it came to contemporary jazz, and you mentioned somebody like Creed Taylor, the technology changed, and the technology gave us as producers a new opportunity, a way to create music. And rock and roll was really like the first place. When you look at the Beatles and you look at George Martin with multi-track recorders, four-track recorders, they came up with a whole other idea of overdubbing and putting pieces together and mixing. And it was something.
Don't forget Les Paul.
And Les Paul, exactly. And, you know, that never happened in jazz before. It was a performance that happened once, and it was like, and that was it. And I look at it like a documentarian in a lot of ways. That was like taking a photograph. It was this one time you photograph it, and it lives forever. I look at contemporary jazz and the technology that afforded us and other producers at that time, starting with Creed and so on. You're a painter. Now you're taking all these other colors and you have a palette and you can put all these colors together and be creative in another sort of way with much more opportunity to move things and try things and overdub things and have a real palette to work with. And that's what we did. And so for us at GRP at that particular time, for Dave and I, it was finding all these incredible young musicians who happened to be living in New York City at that time. When we found somebody like John Lucien, who introduced us to Noel Point, who introduced us to Angela Beaufil, who Dave Valentin, who introduced me to Angela Beaufil. We signed one artist after the next, and we brought him in the studio, and I spent years never coming out of a recording studio. I mean, you know, forget about getting out in the sun. I was like inside the studio all the time making record after record. And it was about the technology and creating the sound that would work. And it was also the music itself. had this fusion component to it. Of course, it wasn't just straight-ahead jazz anymore. There were Latin influences. There were R&B influences. There were rock instruments. There were electronic instruments. So each project called for a slightly different kind of color palette. And it was tremendously a creative time.
Studio as a recording studio as a tool.
It's a laboratory.
Yet another tool. Larry Rosen is our guest, creator and producer in conjunction with the Arsht Center of the Jazz Roots series starting November 1st at the beautiful Arsht Center for the Performing Arts in Miami-Dade County, 1300 Biscayne Boulevard. Go to arshtcenter.org or call 786-468-2000, their administrative offices, or 305-949-6722, their box office, for more information. We'll be back in just a moment with Mr. Dr. Larry Rosen. Ed Bell with you here on South Florida Arts Beat, our second segment with Dr. Larry Rosen. He's the creator and producer in conjunction with the Arsht Center of the 6th Annual Jazz Roots Series. It opens up November 1st. For more information, arshtcenter.org. And Larry, this is, I've been down here since 71 on the air, and this is, in my humble estimate, the most successful jazz series we've ever had in South Florida. And I'm talking on a multi-county basis. Just a phenomenal, incredible job. I'm not going to ask you how you did it because you're Dr. Larry Rosen, but we don't have another hour left with you. But let's talk about the Jazz Roots series. Kicks off November 1st, celebrating a great musician whose music is in many films and whatnot. He had many hits. Henry Mancini.
Right. Well, we call it Pink Panther 50 because it's the 50th anniversary, believe it or not, of the Pink Panther movie.
I loved that as a kid. I loved
it. Me too. I mean,
that
saxophone solo. The saxophone solo was like, and that theme was like.
Was that Plas Johnson?
Yes, Plas Johnson. So Henry Mancini, you know, what was so amazing about him, he really broke a lot of barriers as far as Hollywood film scoring, because before that, you know, most of the score, just about all the scores, were pretty much classical-based music. You know, it was big orchestral kind of music that was the background, and he really took a very contemporary twist. And so Henry Mancini works perfectly for Jazz Roots because it's really telling an incredible story about an unbelievable American composer, but also how he melded that kind of classical background and taking it and bringing it together to a jazz world and then bringing it to the public in a way like, I mean, Peter Gunn, he did the Peter Gunn television show, and that was all about jazz.
Yeah.
All the scoring was jazz, and all the greatest jazz players at that time were playing in those scores. So it was very exciting. So this show will be a celebration of Henry Mancini. And on it are Monica Mancini, his daughter, John Cicada, of course, who from here in Miami, Nicole Henry here in Miami, because part of the thing about Jazz Roots is we want to not only bring in great artists from all around the world, but we want to also bring in artists who are here in Miami and meld them all together.
Bravo, bravo. That's
great. And, of course, Cyril Amé, she is the singer that just won the Sarah Vaughan International Jazz Vocal Competition, which I happen to produce at the New Jersey Performing Arts Center, part of the Jazz Roots that's going on there. So she is just a wonderful singer, and she comes from France. It was an international competition. We do it every year to find the best jazz singers in the world. Tom Scott, obviously one of the great tenor saxophone players, and because the tenor saxophone played such a big role in Henry Mancini. Shelley Berg, you know, as far as I'm concerned, is one of the best things that ever happened to Miami.
Yes,
you know, besides building the cut to get ships in here, it was Shelley Berg. Because what he's done here at the University of Miami and the Frost School of Music and bringing the Mancini Institute here from California is just phenomenal. So, I mean, that's just one heck of a show.
An incredible opening show for the new series coming up November 1st. In our final 6 minutes with Dr. Larry Rosen, let's talk about December 20th. Everybody loves big bands.
Well, it's the holidays, and what's better than Wynton Marsalis and the Jazz at Lincoln Center Big Band to celebrate the holiday season. So we're going to do Jingle Bells here in a new way.
So that band, no doubt, will include a number of really great nationally known players.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
In fact, I think they just backed up Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Uh-huh. Well, he does such
How about that?
Winton is amazing.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah, he does. Willie Nelson, you name it.
Yeah, yeah. January 17th, you bring in a great trumpeter, kind of reminiscent of Chet Baker, no?
Very much. And Chris Bodie is just not only an incredible player, but he engaged audiences in a way that I haven't seen an instrumentalist do in a long, long time. I mean, he's a great jazz player, but he's also a great personality. Mm-hmm. And his work with so many other people, whether it's Barbara Streisand or Sting, is really where he got his big shot. He toured with Sting for a number of years, and that opened up so many doors for him. And when I was doing my Legends of Jazz television show with Ramsey Lewis, he was one of the guests on the show, so I got really to know him pretty well and really talk about his career. And he's just a wonderful artist. And there's been so much support here in Miami. There's an incredible lady here named Sue Miller. And she grabbed me on my jacket one time and she said, I saw Chris Bodie last summer and you must bring him as part of Jazz Roots. I come to every Jazz Roots show and you must have Chris Bodie here. I said, Sue, for you, anything.
Bravo,
the bottom line
bravo.
Is I love having the whole community engaged in these shows, not only to come and see him, but be enthusiastic about it and come with ideas. I mean, what's better than that?
That's part of your secret, I think. You really network beautifully and hit all elements of the South Florida community. February 7th, very excited to have this gentleman back in South Florida. He was a student at the University of Miami. Then I think during a short time there, they said, you got to be a teacher. The Pat Metheny Unity Group, and that's February 7th.
Well, Pat Metheny, needless to say, is one of the jazz guitar gods. And mm-hmm. I wouldn't even put just guitar gods.
Close
right?
to two dozen Grammys.
Oh, yeah.
Close
I mean,
to two
he,
dozen.
He is just an incredible guitarist and musician on all levels and a creator. He's such an inventor of new sounds, and he brings along artists. And, you know, he started his career, actually, with Gary Burton, mm-hmm. who lives here in Fort Lauderdale, actually. And Gary was the one who also nurtured young artists and bring them up. You know, that's what this whole jazz business is about. It's really about mentoring in many ways.
Giving back.
It's giving back. And that's the way guys learn this music, too. Mm-hmm. You know, in the old days, you got on a big band. You were the fourth trumpet player. You sat next to guys who'd been on the road for 30 years.
And that's how they have stories.
That was your school. That was where you went to school. You went on to school on the road.
March 14th, as we move along, New Orleans. You celebrate New Orleans with the great Aaron Neville and the super fun Dirty Dozen Brass
Band.
Well,
this is going to be a great show.
Yeah.
Needless to say, Aaron Neville is a classic. You know,
The
Neville brothers and, of course, Aaron doing his own thing. And this doesn't get too much more New Orleans than this show.
April 11th, you wrap it up with a twist of Jobim. Everybody loves the music of Antonio Carlos Jobim. It'll be a tribute with whom?
Well, I mean, on the show is going to be very interesting, Jobim's family members. There's going to be his daughter, Louisa Jobim, who I don't think ever performed, not only in Miami. This is one of the few times she's ever performed in the United States. We're bringing these folks up from Brazil.
Wow.
Danielle Jobim, his grandson, who really is carrying on the tradition of the Jobim family. And then a special guest, João Bosco, who's like one of the great Brazilian artists. And along with that, my old buddies, Dave Grusin and Lee Ritenour, because they've done so much and worked so much from Sergio Mendez, from working with Antonio Carlos Jobim. Dave and I worked, when we were both working for Andy Williams, he had Antonio Carlos Jobim when The Girl from Ipanema just became a hit on his show, and we played for him a lot. We spent 2 weeks, I'll never forget, at Harris in Lake Tahoe with Jobim, and it was one of the greatest experiences in the world. I mean, this man is like our George Gershwin. He's the George Gershwin of Brazil.
Sure, and I wish Stan Getz were still with us.
No, I'm with you.
So what a blockbuster series. The sixth and annual, we're holding you to that, Jazz Roots Series starts November 1st, 2013 through April the 11th, 2014 at the beautiful Arsht Center for the Performing Arts in Miami-Dade County. Go to Arsht, A-R-S-H-T, center.org for more info. Once again, their administrative offices are 786-468-2000. Their box office is 305-949-6722. Larry, you have your own website as well.
Yeah. Well, certainly go to jazzroots.com and you can find out all about the shows. Do I have time to say one quick thing?
Yes, sir, for you, yes.
Okay. You know, this past season, we recorded a show called Jazz and the Philharmonic. Mm. This is an incredible show with the University of Miami, the Frost School of Music, the Henry Mancini Orchestra, but with a host of stars from Bobby McFerrin to Chick Corea to Dave Grusin to Terrence Blanchard. And I could go on and on and on. And Young Arts, which is another organization here based here in Miami, brought in so many great young artists to be part of this show. Well, we shot it also for a PBS television special.
Bravo.
And so this will be a special on PBS in January 2014. And one thing I must say, the Arch Center in this show, not only does the music sound better than Carnegie Hall or any other place I ever recorded it, I'm serious, but it looks more beautiful as well. So I just want to keep that on the radar. We're doing something in Miami that's breaking ground all over the world. It's unique what we're doing here. So I want people not to take this for granted.
Well, thank you for breaking ground for us over all of these wonderful decades. Please keep doing it. You're a delight. Your productions are incredible, whether they're on TV or radio or live at your Jazz Roots, and Jazz Roots to be found in many cities across the country. Congratulations on your recent doctorate from the Manhattan School of Music. You and Dave Grusin were honored just a few nights ago, and thanks so much for joining us on South Florida Arts Beat, Mr. Larry Rosen. Dr. Larry Rosen, we have to call him now.
I don't take insurance.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you.
It's South Florida Arts Beat on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Coming up on the program, Chef Norman Van Aken whips up A Word on Food, and our Florida Keys calendar features Andy Newman with enticing event suggestions. Now, our arts contributor Judith Bishop speaks with the executive director and chief curator of yet another of Miami's renowned art museums.
Universities are defined by many factors. At the University of Miami, the Low Art Museum is one of those defining characteristics. The museum opened in 1952, and its permanent collection now tops 17,000 pieces. The art spans centuries and cultures, with objects from Greco-Roman antiquities through the Renaissance and Baroque periods. There is also early art from the Americas, Chinese treasures, and a modern glass wing that includes masterpieces by Dale Chihuly, Richard Jolly, and William Carson. It's housed in a $3.5 million wing named for donors Myrna and Sheldon Paley. In keeping with the educational setting, the Low sponsors an annual exhibition of faculty and student work. It's called Art Lab at the Low, and we'll be talking about that later with our guest. Guiding the Low Museum is the director and chief curator, Brian Dersom. He has been on the job for over 20 years and has overseen the Low's expansion. Brian Dersom is an expert in Asian art, and he is our guest today on South Florida Arts Beat. Brian Dersom, welcome to South Florida Arts Beat. With over two decades at the helm of the Low Museum, you just may be the dean of curators in South Florida. Looking back over your long tenure there, what makes you smile the most? What were some of the greatest hits, the greatest accomplishments of your time?
Actually, when I became the director, I had three things I wanted to achieve. One was redo the building. At the time, they were trying to do a new building, which, as it turned out, didn't work out. To catalog the collection, and to start building an endowment for the museum. And the building did come about. We started the process in 93. We opened it in 96, the first phase. We added again to the building. We renovated the whole building as well. We added again in 2008 with the Myrna and Sheldon Paley Pavilion, glass and decorative, actually of studio arts. And the book we produced that, the first handbook of the permanent collection, which had been done in years. And the endowment took a lot longer, but we are now at close to $6 million in endowment. So I'm actually quite pleased with that. In addition to which, the collection has expanded. It's about tripled since I was director, became director in 1990. It stands at about 18,000 objects now.
Well, acquisition is certainly a big part of your job. If you had a wish list, what would you like to do to improve or to change or add to the museum?
In terms of collection?
Yes.
We have a great big list. And because the museum's collection is almost encyclopedic. It's fairly broad anyway, and we cover just about everything except European and American decorative arts, and by that I mean ceramics and furniture and things of that sort. So the list is long. I want a Diane Arbus photograph for the museum's collection. They're not inexpensive. We have a group called Director Circle, and there are high-end members. They pay $1,200 a year, and they get the honor of being a member of the museum, but also of attending a black tie dinner in April, where we pick the most expensive object that we can buy for that given year, and they vote on it. And customarily, it is entirely their choice. This year, we changed it a little bit. The curator who was working on Pan-American Modernism wanted a specific artist for the collection for that show, and it was Torres Garcia, Joaquin Torres Garcia, who's a Uruguayan artist and a very, very important artist for the show. And so we narrowed it down to just that one artist. We've never done that before. So I said, like Diane Arbus, but I don't think I would go to them and say, we're going to do modern U.S. photography, and Diane Arbus has to be your choice. So I'll more than likely give them, you know, a choice of 4 to 6, you know, different photographs to choose from. And then we'll be happy with whatever they pick, you know, and I'll have to cry later about not getting Diane Arbus if that's the case. Many of them may be listening. And
what else is on the wish list?
We do have a wish list for an African piece, a very specific Bakoto reliquary, which are at this point in time horribly, horribly expensive. They're anywhere between $40,000 and $70,000 to buy something like that. But it's high on my list. It's high on the curator's list. We're hoping that there is a New York patron who has one. We like it. He likes us. We're hoping that rather than having to buy it, that he'll simply donate it to us.
It's interesting because your obvious passion is art, your expertise is art. But yes, there's a lot of business dealing involved in your position. At any museum, very special exhibitions are the key to attracting new visitors and to serving the existing community. And right now, you have several of them going on. One of them, Brian Curtis's work, which is inspired by Stonehenge. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Brian's been on the staff of the university in the art department for a number of years. And he's really a consummate painter. You know, everything he does is very, very painterly. It is, in a sense, a kind of odd show that you'd pick one specific monument to do. But I don't see that – someone said that to me, but I don't see that really much different than any of the 19th century artists picking out a specific monument, for example, Notre Dame or, you know
– A good example of that, of course, is Monet's treatment of the cathedral at Rouen.
Exactly. And doing it at different times of the day and different lights and things like that. So I don't see that as really something particularly new. And I think it's kind of interesting that he would go back to that type of technique and style. So I think it's interesting. I think that the MFA show is quite strong this year. I was really quite pleased with the way it looked. And the students are charged with actually installing it themselves. They work with a faculty member. The museum staff only gets involved when they want help, when they need lighting and things like that. We have to do it because we're the only ones who can manage the equipment. But essentially, they do it, and that's something that's quite nice.
Another show you have currently, it combines art and history, and that's the charting of Captain Cook's journeys to the South Pacific.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And that's an interesting – how did that come about?
Well, it's actually my assistant director who is finishing her master's degree in art. She has a master's degree in museum sciences and museum studies, but she wanted to do an MA in art history. So she undertook that, and that was her choice for a master's thesis. And we've done – some master's thesis in the past at the museum. But when she came to me and said, I'd like to do this, I said, yes, let's do it. Oh, by the way, that particular collection that was donated by the man who owns the African Bakoto reliquary too.
Comes full circle.
Yes. So we're hoping to, you know, tease him a little bit with the fact that he knows we use the works he gives, and that's really important too.
Another favorite is Art Lab. It's the work of students and professors. How do you make that choice and put it together diplomatically?
Well, we actually go to faculty and in a specific field. This year, it's an anthropologist, Tracy Ardrin, who is also a senior associate dean at this point in time. She's going to become the chairman of the anthropology department. We went to her and said, you know, we'd like to do something about Panama. She's a Mayanist. So we picked we essentially suggested the topic. And then what they select, or what she selects with the students, is really entirely up to them. They have the whole collection to go through to really do that, and the whole section of Panama anyway, so Native American and Ancient America. And they did an admirable job. It really is a beautiful show. And it gets bigger. It gets better every single year. I did it last year. It was a very different show. So that's one of the most surprising things, what the students really come up with, because they do everything, picking the object, researching the object, writing about the object. Of course, the professor has to be the editor. They pick the colors. They pick the typeface. Everything that we would normally do with any show, they do with the show. And it's done in a very, very – it's done in one semester. So it's very, very brief and very short. It's a seminar. And the result stays up for a year. And they get their name in a book.
It sounds like ideal on-the-job training.
Yeah, it's
practical,
fabulous.
Practical, hands-on. The newest wing at the museum is dedicated to modern glass, and one of my favorites, Dale Chihuly, is represented. Mm-hmm. Describe some of the prized works that you have.
Oh, we have a number of pieces. We have William Morris, who, interestingly enough, is no longer working in glass. He was a phenomenal glass artist. He worked with Chihuly. He was working out at the Chihuly Studios in Seattle and produced these incredible glass pieces, inspired sometimes by ancient mythology. He's done, for example, canopic jars. He has one there that was inspired by Africa. And he did the one work. Lynn Arison, who bought the piece, loved the work so much she commissioned him to do an entire installation for her apartment. And when Lynn was changing things around and she found out that we were doing this gallery, she said, "I'll donate it to you." And we were thrilled. So it's an on permanent view. We have Bob Arneson, who we did an exhibition of back in the – I met him back in the early 80s. And I'd always wanted a piece, but they were always horribly expensive. And it's a great representation of funk art from California. And it is, of course, all sort of self-serving because everything is Arneson. And this particular piece is no different. It's called Flat Nose Nasal. And basically, he leaned up against the glass and flattened his nose out. And then he sculpted himself with the hair sticking out. It's quite outstanding. And the donors who gave us that piece came back to me later and said, "Well, is there another ceramic you want?" Because it's not only about glass. We do have Chihuly in there. We have a number of other people. It's also about other kinds of fine studio art, art in a media that most people have regarded for years as purely decorative and not really in the mainstream of the media that would normally be used by an artist, which is untrue. And that is Peter Volkos, who died a number of years ago. We own a big painting by Peter Volkos. Nobody thinks he ever did painting. But he did plates and he did all kinds of things, stacks.
Lots to see, lots of diversity at the Lowe. Brian Dersom, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Judy.
The Lowe Art Museum is located on the University of Miami campus in Coral Gables. The Lowe is open Tuesday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. On Sunday, doors open at noon and close at 4. The museum is also closed every Monday and all university holidays. For more information, log on to lowemuseum.org or telephone them at 305-284-3535. For South Florida Arts Beat, this is Judith Bishop.
Judith Bishop is a television journalist and executive producer who has covered breaking news, politics, and the arts for WABC and CNBC. She has produced documentaries for WNET and is currently a contributor to WLRN-TV, Channel 17. Please stay with us. South Florida Arts Beat will continue in just a moment. Welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat. Ed Bell with you. It's quite an honor for us to include the renowned chef Norman Van Aken on the show. Here's his segment, A Word on Food.
I don't want French fried potatoes, red ripe tomatoes. I'm never satisfied. I want the frim-fram sauce with the aus and fade, with shafafa on the side. Shoot do de do ya do do.
Hi, I'm Norman Van Aken, and welcome to A Word on Food. Today's word on food, boniato. Back in the late 1990s, at the original Norman's restaurant in Coral Gables, we had a young man who became our lunch chef named Eliseer Garcia. Like many young chefs, he was very interested in cuisines from all over. And when we talked about what to put on our lunch menu, his ideas ranged from France to Hong Kong. I love that. But sometimes I'd say, Eliseer, I want you to show me flavors your Cuban grandmother would make. And then we can twist them a little, okay? Why don't you show me how she would cook with, boniato, for instance. And then we'll go from there. Many WLRN listeners already know I am the person who introduced the term fusion cooking into the lexicon of global cooking. I know that there are some who don't like me for it, but I'm not sure how many folks ever heard or read the original thesis I presented in Santa Fe, New Mexico, on fusion cooking in 1988. It was not about mixing food in an anything-goes, mindless kind of way. It was about a wedding, yes, or a fusion, to put it another way, of conservative or rustic cookery with progressive cooking, as an inquisitive chef, as I am, would seek out. I like to think of it as the best of both worlds. Grandma's cooking with a knowledge of physics and such. So I listened to Eliseer and how his abuela prepared boniato at her home in Kendall, knowing full well I was not going to go exactly in her tracks, but be guided by them, as any smart cook would. Boniato has a number of other names. Cuban sweet potato and batata are two of the more common ones. This may get confusing, but here we go. In the 1930s, a very sweet, orange-fleshed sweet potato was introduced as the Louisiana yam, a marketing ploy that was intended to distinguish it from the similar but firmer variety that was grown in the Northeast. That orange variety is not in any respect a true yam. It is boniato, called that primarily because Cuban people are the main growers and consumers of this starch in the U.S., and that's the name they know it by. In Central America, where this potato originated, it might be called camote. The Cubans called it boniato because the words mean sweet and harmless to them, as opposed to hot or picante. It may be harmless, but it is also very good, and it is less sweet than our sweet potato. Its flavor is chestnut-like. Boniatos are not as sweet and moist as other sweet potatoes, but many people prefer their fluffier consistency and more delicate flavor. In Spain, it is common to see boniato and chestnuts in a combined mash. I think I'd like that. In certain parts of the world, sweet potatoes are locally known by other names, including goguma, mantet, ubi jalar, ubi geladec, shakar khand, satsuma imo, and el boniato. Chef Eliseer came up to me one day back then and said, I have a lunch special I'd like to run tomorrow, Chef, if you approve, of course. It would be soy-glazed and grilled local mahi on a mash of boniato with mojo. Is that what you meant by twisting my Cuban dishes around? I replied, exacto. And you know what? I think his grandmother would love it. I'm Norman Van Aken, and that's my word on food.
Norman Van Aken is the author of My Key West Kitchen and is also the director of restaurants for the Miami Culinary Institute and Tuyo in downtown Miami. Tune in this coming Saturday morning at 8:34 on Weekend Edition to hear Caesar Salad. And here's our South Florida Arts Beat entertainment calendar. And today we welcome back Mr. Andy Newman of the Florida Keys and Key West Tourism Council. Andy, how's life?
Life is great, and it's always good to be with you.
And I'm sure it's even better in the beautiful Florida Keys. Tell me about it.
Better in the fabulous Florida Keys, of course, Ed. And these are some of the events that are on the Florida Keys website at flakeys.com. Now, first of all, this Saturday, it is the Mara Tri 7. It's a marathon triathlon in Marathon. Begins at 8 o'clock in the morning at San Barrow Beach. They're expecting some 100 triathletes to set off. It's a family-friendly event, and it has become a fundraiser for Marathon High School athletic teams. There's a half-mile swim, a 13.6-mile bike ride, and a 3.1-mile run. Now, other events coming up in the Keys, Ed, in Key West, June 5th to the 9th, Key West Pride. Key West, of course, shows its pride every day. This is a chance to be part of the celebration. It includes a film festival, dance parties, drag shows, bike tours, water excursions, a street fair, and a Pride in Our Community parade down Duval Street. June 7th to the 9th, staying in Key West, the 4th annual Key West Bacchanalia. It's a food and wine event with a twist, opportunity to join key celebrity chefs as they face off in a culinary competition with a great cause in mind. Still staying in Key West, Ed, a new event June 13th to the 16th, the Key West Africana Festival. It's an opportunity to explore music, art, and Key West Afro-Caribbean culture during a three-day destination retreat. It's focusing on thought, cultural, and wellness, and it integrates Key West Bahama Village, the island's African refugee cemetery, and the historic Henrietta Marie salvage slave ship. Going to still stay in Key West, Ed. June 15th, the Discovery Saturday Educational Series will be called Guard the Fort. This is being presented by the Florida Keys Eco Discovery Center, and it starts at 10 a.m. and continues to 11 a.m. again on June 15th. Play games, make crafts while learning about a new topic of interest, and this is all about guarding the fort, and this will sort of make the fort a surprise for folks. Ed, let's head up to Alamorada. June 19th, the History of Diving Museum presents the search for the pirate slaver Guerrero. This is a special event. It's free, and it's presented by Corey Malcolm. He's the director of archaeology for the Mel Fisher Maritime Museum. Back down to the southernmost city in the continental United States on June 19th, the South Florida Symphony Orchestra will be presenting American in Paris. Back up to Alamorada on June 20th, the next day, the Maradaway Arts and Cultural District is presenting its third Thursday Art Walk. It showcases the fine arts, the music, and culinary nuances of the Purple Isles. It's a great event. I always enjoy going to it. Between mile marker 81 and 82, Oceanside. Up to Key Largo, the top of the Florida Keys, Ocean Life Lecture Series, Cuba, The Accidental Eden. It's being presented at the Murray Nelson Government and Cultural Center in Key Largo. And Fernando Bretas will share stories from his 13-year effort in Cuba to study the marine resources shared between the U.S. and Cuba, particularly sea turtles and coral reefs. Talking about coral reefs and water, back down to Key West, June 22nd to the 23rd, the Key West Island Swim, Florida Keys Community College Swim Around Key West. It's a United States Master Swimming Sanction event, a 12.5-mile swim clockwise around the island of Key West that's open for all age groups. Still in Key West, June 22nd, the 7th Annual Midsummer's Night Dream and Spectacle. It's a night of artistic expression, music, feasting, dancing, and singing, and all celebrating the art and artists of the Florida Keys, being staged at and benefiting the Key West Tropical Forest and Botanical Garden. Coming up, Happy Birthday America, July 4th activities up in Key Largo, fireworks show on Blackwater Sound. In Alamorada, fireworks and family fun at Founders Park. In Marathon on July 4th, the Marathon Beach Party and fireworks show. That'll be at Sombrero Beach. In Big Pine in the Lower Key, celebrate the 4th of July with fireworks at the Sugarloaf Airport, which is adjacent to the quirky Bat Tower. We'll have to talk about the Bat Tower one day, Ed.
Okay.
The bats never came, by the way. And then down in Key West on July 4th, Ed, the 29th Annual Hospice Visiting Nurses Association July 4th Picnic. It'll be at the Casa Marina Resort and Beach Club. That'll start at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Fireworks starting at 9 p.m., courtesy of the Key West Rotary Club. Now, July 4th is all about America. What else can be America except for a key lime pie? Oh, wait a minute. Isn't that supposed to be apple pie? But heck, we're the Florida Keys, so it's got to be key lime pie.
Mm.
And so the inaugural edition of the Key Lime Pie Festival, it's July 4th to the 6th. It is an all-American celebration of Florida's official and one of the most tasty pies.
Yes.
Highlights, there's a Miss Key Lime Pie, a Little Miss Key Lime Pie pageant, a pie-eating contest, and the Key Lime Pie competition. Again, July 4th to the 6th. Taking a look at some other events coming up here in July in Big Pine and the Lower Keys, the Sugarloaf Bike and Paddle Tour, that's July 6th. And July 11th to 14th in Key West, Mel Fisher Days honors Key West's most famous treasure hunter. And, of course, one of the highlight events of the summertime in the Florida Keys, the 29th Annual Underwater Music Festival. That's Saturday, July 13th. This, is, of course, is a quirky concert. It is broadcast by a radio station. Special speakers that are suspended above the reef at Lou Key Reef in the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary we get about between 400 and 600 snorkelers and divers that come out to listen to music underwater. They dance underwater. They just have a great time. And you know what? The fish and the lobster, they seem to enjoy it as well. And we will leave you, Ed, of course, the highlight event, I believe, for the summertime, the 16th through the 21st in Key West, the annual Hemingway Day celebration. This will be the 33rd annual celebration of the legendary author's work and lifestyle. It'll feature literary readings, a theatrical premiere, short story contest judged by Lauren Hemingway, Ernest Hemingway's granddaughter. There's the Key West Rambouillet Blue Marlin Tournament. And, of course, the annual Hemingway Day Sloppy Joe's Look-Alike Contest. You can get much more information on the Hemingway Day Festival and all of the events in the Florida Keys on the Florida Keys website, flakeys.com.
That's the always informative Andy Newman of the Florida Keys and Key West Tourism Council. Andy, thank you so much and great weekend to you, sir.
Great weekend to you too, Ed.
Let me add, if I may, you can enjoy 4 hours of travel and music nostalgia on WLRN-TV, Channel 17's Latin Music Night. Mark your calendar, Sunday, June 2nd, 7 p.m. till 11:30 p.m., WLRN-TV, Channel 17's Latin Music Night. And Miami Music Month continues for just a few more days. It's an exciting program available through May 31st when locals and visitors can enjoy special exhibits, world-class permanent collections, memorials, and much, much more with buy one, get one free, and join one, see them all offerings. Find out all about those two programs. For more information on Miami Music Month, please visit miamimusicmonth.com and Miami Music Month is organized by the Greater Miami Convention and Visitors Bureau. We'll rebroadcast South Florida Arts Beat tonight and every Friday night at 7 o'clock on our WLRN Extra HD channel. You can tune in on your HD radio or go to our beautiful website at WLRN.org for more information. And that's today's edition of South Florida Arts Beat. We hope you enjoyed the show. Adrian Kennedy is our executive producer. I'm Ed Bell, producer and host. Our theme was composed by Mike Levine and performed by Mike and Sam Levine. Special thanks to our technical director today, Andy Wagner, and our contributors, Judith Bishop, Norman Van Aken, and Andy Newman. Please call us with your comments, 305-995-2258. You can fax us your event information to 305-995-2221 or email it to us at info@WLRN.org. We'd like to hear from you. Monday at this time, we'll feature topical currents with hosts Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, Monday at 1 o'clock. Have yourself a great weekend, and please, as always, keep your dial set right here to 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. Until next time, this is Ed Bell saying bye-bye. Enjoy. Happy holiday.